VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Matt Dickinson, and for this edition of Lifetimes, I sat down with Fran Kirby. The Chelsea and England forward, once described as a mini Messi, will carry many of England's hopes at the World Cup this summer. But she reveals just how tough it has been to make it to the top.
The journey from 1991's 80-minute matches to a 2019 sellout opener at the Parc des Princes should not be underestimated or forgotten. The time is now. England feel like that. They have been on some trek. Slow burners throughout the 2000s, led by Kelly Smith. They hit their high point 4 years ago, a bronze medal which is cherished in the women's game. Now they are going for gold. Navigated by Neville, powered by Paris, picked on by Kirby.
So welcome. I mean, I'm sure we'll get into a lot more detail about gender equality and where the women's game is going. But, you know, I first wanted to talk about your game itself. I mean, you're 25 now. I mean, does that feel like coming into prime years? How does it feel for you?
I feel like I've been around for a long time now. You know, obviously when I first came into the scene with England, you know, people were a bit surprised of, you know, who I was as a player. And, you know, coming from the only WSL2 team, you know, I did feel very inexperienced compared to a lot of the other girls. I didn't really play much at youth age groups, whereas a lot of the girls had come through at England, you know, 15, 17s, 19s. I didn't do any of that really. A bit inexperienced at the time, but now, you know, obviously I'm a bit more established, you know, in the team. And, you know, I'm playing a lot in front of a lot of big crowds. So, you know, I am experienced in that sense.
And, I mean, I'd say, don't want to load you up with too many expectations, but, you know, a lot of people saying very positive things about you. I mean, Phil Neville, obviously the England manager, said, I think, you know, I'll take our number 10s over Brazil's, which, again, I mean, obviously reference to Marta, who is a sort of icon in the game. I mean, when you hear stuff like that, how does... Do you think great, or do you think, oh, I could do without it?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think, you know, obviously I've had a lot of names tagged along me along the way. You know, I've just had to kind of take them on the chin and, you know, try and focus on myself. And, you know, it does come with added pressure when someone says something like that to you, you know, obviously because, you know, Marta is a legend in the women's game. There's no denying that. And she still is to this day one of the best players in the women's game. So it's a massive compliment for your manager to say that about you. And obviously it shows the belief that he has in me as a player. And, you know, it makes you, you know, drive a bit more and, you know, it makes you feel confident going into the next game. So it's a bit backwards and forwards. But yeah, obviously you want your manager to compliment you because then you feel like you're doing something right.
When we're making those comparisons, I have to throw it in, but how did your teammates respond when Mini Messi came up? That was from Mark Sampson, wasn't it, the previous England women's coach?
That was a bit, obviously, I was still quite inexperienced then, and it was my first World Cup, and obviously that kind of tag stuck. And it was quite funny, because I remember the girls, you know, they would, kind of joke about it in training, or, you know, they'd be like, oh, we've got Mini Messi on our team and stuff, you know, it's just normal banter, you know. And, you know, to be fair, a lot of the girls still now to this day would be like, oh, we've got our Mini Messi and stuff like that. So yeah, it's all good fun, and it's, you know, it's a nickname that has stuck with me, and, you know, I'm trying to emulate as much as I can. Obviously, you don't think that I'm there, but, you know, it's a great nickname to have, and, you know, it does come with the added pressure, but it's going to be pressure no matter what, whether you're playing for Chelsea or England, the two top teams in football. So,
I mean, for the record, you're 5'2".
Is it? At a push. That's always
with the heels on.
Yeah. I always have to wear the bigger heels because I'm so small.
But that's interesting. But you say you think it might have made you a more, shall we, inventive, sort of resourceful player because of that.
Yeah, definitely. I had to adapt my game, you know, because a lot of the time when I was growing up, I played in leagues where, you know, it wasn't fancy football. It was very physical. It was very, you know, that wasn't my game. You know, I was so small. I wasn't strong. I had no muscles. You know, I went to a World Cup not even knowing what a gym session was, really. You know, I hadn't done it, you know, because I wasn't in the professional environment as everyone else was. So, you know, I learned very quickly, you know, I had to put some muscle on, otherwise I was just going to get pushed off the ball all the time. So, you know, it was a big mind change for me, and definitely one thing that I've grown up learning a lot about is how to look after your body and make sure that, you know, you're not too weak, that people are able to push you off the ball.
But you feel a lot more robust generally playing the game.
Yeah, definitely. You know, honestly, when I used to play, I was like a twig, you know, when I first came in, you know, I had no muscles about me, you know, I got injured, started working in the gym, you know, obviously I was out for a good year and a bit, so, you know, I put a bit of meat on, a bit of beef, which I needed to do, and then, you know, tried to use that into a different strength and try and build it up into muscle, which I managed to do. And, you know, I definitely needed that because I don't think I would have been able to compete at international level at all, you know, if I was still the same way that I was before, you know, coming into Chelsea and stuff.
I mean, on that, how far do you think the England team are? I mean, I think the Americans generally have a reputation for being the athletes, is that right?
Yeah.
Maybe the Germans too. Is that something that's just simply a question of the game getting more and more professional, catching up?
I think so. I think you've definitely seen a difference since, you know, our league has gone professional, more of the girls becoming professional in our league, and, you know, within the England team as well, you know, even still some of the girls weren't professional a few years ago in the England team. So I think it's definitely improving in that sense, and I still think that there's still a way to go, but, you know, we are getting to the same level now as these teams who have been able to be professional for so long and, you know, be able to push ourselves, like you saw when we won the She Believes. You know, it was a massive turning point, I think, for this England team and how we can build our confidence and show that we can compete against the best.
That sort of dead eye finishing that you've certainly been one of your strengths. Is that, I mean, obviously all these skills take work, but was that something you found did come quite naturally to you as when you were learning the game?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, last year was probably the year where I actually really worked on it. You know, after training, I would stay and do my own shooting, even into an empty net, you know, taking a touch inside and finishing. But I've always been quite confident in front of goal. You know, obviously, you know, there's games where I don't score and I miss three chances and I'm disappointed about it, but, you know, I'm never going to not try again. And I think that's one thing that I've learned, you can miss three chances, but you need to keep taking them chances, whether you're missing, whether people are getting annoyed that you're missing, people are disappointed because you're missing, but, you know, you're never going to overcome something like that unless you keep going and keep trying. It was when I, you know, first started taking penalties for England. I missed my first two penalties that I took for England, but, you know, I had to stick at it. I had to keep going. You know, now I've scored the rest of my penalties that I've had.
And without giving any trade secrets away, but what's your, when you're doing the long walk of what would be hell to most of us, what do you try and think of a particular thing? Do you, you know, what's your thought process?
I think I just try and think about when I was a kid, and, you know, I'd play football in the park, or I'd play football with my brother on the street, and just try and turn into that kid again where you just loved football and it was just so exciting and everything was great. And I play my best football when I'm smiling, when I'm looking like I'm just in the park playing football with my friends. So I try and take myself to that kind of area, trying to keep myself calm. Yeah, I'd probably say that would be my biggest thing when I'm trying to take a penalty, trying to keep myself calm and try and think about enjoying it rather than being scared of it.
Okay. And is that an approach you use generally? Not, I mean, not just for penalties, trying to get yourself into that sort of mindset?
Yeah, I try not to take things too seriously, especially with football, because, like I said, I'm better when I have fun. You know, when I'm when I'm not in a good way, or, you know, I'm not very strong mentally, or I'm very low on confidence, that's when I'm a bit more serious, and that's when I can't enjoy it, and that's probably when I perform at my worst.
Right.
So yeah, I just try and have fun, you know, because I play football because I love it. I don't play football for any other reason, so why should I not act like I love it when I play? You know, if someone does a trick against me and it works, you know, I have a laugh about it, or, you know, and that's just the way that I am. Or in the change room, I try and do something silly and make people think that I'm weird because, you know, I just want to have fun. You get some people obviously who are zoned in, headphones on, everything's like ready to go, and then, you know, I'm trying to throw water on people and stuff like that. So yeah, that's just the way that I try and handle it.
And that's that works best for you. I mean, it's I know you, I saw you recently have contributed to, I think it was a UEFA campaign, was it a mental health campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Something yeah. I wanted to touch on, but I know it sort of matters to you, but is that why did you feel like you should contribute to that, and what do you hope people gain from it?
A lot of the experiences that I've had is what a lot of people go through every day. You know, I just wanted to get my story out there. You know, a lot of the time people see you as a footballer. You know, they think that nothing is going to affect you. You know, your life is great. You do what you love every day. And, you know, you go to work, you have no problems. But I think one thing that I've really tried to push, especially with the women's game, because, you know, we are a lot more accessible than the men's are. That's just the way it is. We are more, probably a bit more out there with the fans. You know, we communicate more with the fans. And I think, you know, for me, I wanted people to make them aware that we're not robots. You know, we go through traumas. Some of my teammates go through, you know, difficult times in their lives, and everyone has that in their life. And I don't think people should think that athletes don't struggle with daily struggles that, you know, a normal 9-to-5 working job people have. And I think that was one thing that I really wanted to get across, as well as the fact, you know, that sometimes situations are hard for you, but I want people to show that you can come out of the other end as long as you get the help that you need and you understand. You know, they like I said in the thing, that it's okay to not be okay.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the biggest thing that I wanted to get out of it.
And you mentioned traumas, and I know, I'm sure it's a very sort of difficult subject to talk about, but just so people understand, you lost your mum very suddenly, age 14,
mm-hmm.
and I think you've been very open about just how that threw you in a very big way for a number of years.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it was a very difficult period for myself and for my family. And you know, like you say, it was so sudden. You know, she had a brain hemorrhage, which was no signs coming or anything like that. You know, it was literally just one minute she was there smiling, and the next minute, you know, she had passed out. And it was very traumatic for myself and for obviously everyone else who was in the room.
You were at home with her at the time?
No, so we were actually, so at the end of our academy year, we have a meeting, kind of the coaches sit across from the room like we are now, and they go through a list of what you've done well, what you haven't done well, and everything like that. So we're just having a normal conversation. So she was sat to the left of me, so she'd probably been about there, and then, you know, she was laughing at something that the coach the other side said, and then she's, oh, I don't feel very well, put her head on the table, and then, you know, that was kind of it. That was probably the last moment, you know, that she was conscious. So yeah, it was very traumatic for everyone who was around, and you know, it was a very difficult period for my family and for myself.
As a teenager, extremely difficult to know where to turn to, I guess. And I think I'm right in saying that was part of the trouble. You didn't know who to speak to or what to say to anyone.
Yeah, it was. You know, I live. You know, obviously it was my dad and my brother, so I live with two males who don't know how to express their emotions anyway. So I think I was probably the more openly emotional about it. You know, I didn't really know what was going on behind closed doors with my dad and my brother. Obviously, I'm very aware they were probably very emotional also, but, you know, they're male. They don't want to be seen to have these emotions. And I kind of shut myself away because I didn't know how to deal with it. You know, I'd come from being this young girl who was so happy, confident, smiley, would get on with anyone, to someone who didn't want to leave their bedroom. And I didn't know how to go through that transition. I didn't know how to get myself out there again and be a normal person again. You know, I struggled for many years with just getting out of bed. You know, that was the biggest struggle for me, was just getting out of bed. And, you know, that was, I think it got to a stage where I went to sixth form, and I walked to the bus stop to go to sixth form, got on the bus, went into town. I had to get another bus from town. I remember just sitting at the bus stop, and I just started to cry. And I remember I called the Reading woman physio. Her name was Julie Tamra at the time. She was amazing, helping me for everything. I just said, I need you to come and pick me up. I can't do this anymore. And then that day, she drove me home to her house. I just lay on a sofa for the whole day. I think I didn't move from 9 o'clock in the morning to about 9 o'clock at night. I just stayed there all day and just had a really honest conversation about like what was going on and what I needed to do to get help. And she was amazing. She was one of the driving forces who told me to open up to my dad, to speak to my dad about it, and, you know, to try and get myself right. So, yeah, it was very hard to, like I say, go from someone who was so open and so happy to, you know, someone who couldn't even walk 100 yards without breaking down. So it was quite tough.
And have you had any grief counselling at all at this stage? Or
not at the time, no, because I hadn't let it kind of grow. You know, the next day after, you know, my mum passed away, I went to school. Wow. You know, I just pretended that nothing had happened. I went to a trip to watch the rugby with the school. I was, you know, my brother was going through his GCSEs. I was just starting my GCSEs. You know, we just kind of got on with life like nothing had happened. You know, we didn't speak about my mum in the house. We didn't, you know, it was always just passing comments, you know, like, oh, your mum would kill you if your room looked like that and she was here. You know, that was as much as it kind of got to do with my mum. It was a complete blur, really. And
it was almost waiting, something was waiting to come out.
It was always brewing, I think. Yeah. It was always going to hit me eventually. And, you know, I think I was very actually quite lucky that it hit me when it did. Because obviously if it hits you at the age I'm at now, you know, it's very difficult to play in a career or to, you know, enjoy a career that you have. So I was quite lucky in a sense, you know, if you can be lucky in a situation like that. But yeah, no, I didn't have any kind of counselling about it until I opened up to my dad and said, look, dad, like, well, it was actually Julie Tamro who just sat there and just said, look, she's depressed. She needs to see someone. She needs to speak to someone. So yeah, then I started kind of going to someone, speak to someone. But then I kind of transitioned into kind of being with my friends again. So then that kind of helped a lot. You know, I shut my friends out for a long time. So then when I was kind of around my friends, we would speak more openly about it. So then I kind of healed that way as well. So yeah.
In this time, as you say, you shut yourself away, and you shut yourself away from football as well, which had been such a big part of your life.
Yeah, I remember I went up north to visit my family because all my family are from north, and it was the first time I'd visit them since everything had happened. It was my mum's sisters. And I remember I was just sat there with them, and I was like, I just don't want to do it anymore. I just don't want to play. I just don't enjoy it. I don't like going out in the evenings when it's freezing cold, getting up in the morning to go to training. I just don't want to do it anymore. I just don't love it. And it was the first time, because my family have always been so driven with football and everything was football, you know, oh my God, she's so good at football. Like, she's going to be the best, da, 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 da. And it was the first time in my life that I spoke to someone who didn't care about football. And they just said, well, quit. You don't need to do it. If you don't love it anymore, then do something else. And that was the first time that someone had even mentioned anything like that to me. I remember just sitting there thinking, do you know what? You're right. Like, I can grow this love back. I can go and maybe I want to do something else. So I was on the train on the way home. I messaged Julie. I said, I need you to help me to tell Reading that I don't want to play. And Reading were amazing. They were so good dealing with it. They just said, look, we'll give you all the help you need. We won't force you to come back. We won't push you to come back. You need to get yourself right. And it was the best decision that I've ever made, I think, really? Doing that, yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess it's understandable that given what you've been through, nothing would matter in your life at that point, really.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I still trained. I still went to the gym. I still, you know, got involved with sessions if I felt like it. But there was no pressure. All my life I've been driven with, she's going to play for England.
Even at 12, 13?
Yeah. Right. You know, all my life, you know, all the coaches had been saying it. Oh, she's going to play for England. Her, like, she's the best. You know, I was winning a lot of individual awards growing up, you know, best player of the tournament, best player of the year and everything like that, you know, at youth age group. So, you know, I probably struggled a lot with the pressure when I was younger, but when I was younger, I just loved it so much that I didn't really think anything of it. It was when I started to, you know, deal with all these different emotions where I kind of just thought, I've had enough. And then, you know, I joined a Sunday league team a few years later, turned up on the day, didn't train during the week, didn't have to warm up, just went and played. And it was great, you know, and I think that's why it's so important that when you do play, it's just for enjoyment. You know, you can't play something that you don't love.
So that's how you got back into the game, was it? Just doing it for fun?
Yeah, absolutely. It didn't matter whether we lost, whether we won, whether I scored, whether I didn't, whether I gave the ball away. Everyone would laugh if you made a mistake. You know, it wasn't serious at all. And, you know, I was playing with my best friend, you know, had a great time, had a great laugh, played some games. And then I was like, do you know what? I'm ready now. I can do this again now. I love this again now. So yeah, that was really important for me.
And how much, just on your mum, I mean, I imagine, like all parents of keen kids, lots of taxi driving around the place and so on. She played a big part in getting you into football as well.
Yeah, she was like my coach, but not coach. You know, she was the one who would get me up in the morning, make me breakfast. She would be in the bathtub with the toothbrush brush in the boots after the game, making sure that I've got enough food to go to football, and driving me around everywhere, up at 5 o'clock in the morning to drive me to London to play against Charlton or someone, you know, like far, far away from Reading. Yeah, she was the real driving force of everything to do with my football. And, you know, she would make sure that I was always ready to go and, you know, never once complained. Never once complained about having to drive me anywhere, having to wash my boots, the only time she complained is when I said I didn't want to go because it was raining. That was the only time that she complained. She was pulling me out of the bed, dragging me in the car, telling me to, you know, get over it, come on, you need to play. Never once complained, and she just loved it. She loved football more than I do, I think.
But you got your love back for it, which is why you're here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so what happened? So you start playing again with a friend, and then did you make contact with Reading, or did they make contact with you? Or?
So I was in a sixth form, John Medeski Academy, where we were playing football alongside studying BTEC and A-levels. So I kind of joined in with them again, started training with them again. And then they kind of came to me in the car park and they were like, look, we're struggling for players this weekend. It was Sunderland away, so I think a lot of the girls were like, nah, we're not going up there so far. So yeah, I just said, look, okay, I'm happy to do this, but I don't want any pressure to come with it. Like, I'm going to sign for you, but I might want to train sometimes, I might not want to train sometimes, you know. This isn't me trying to be like, I don't want to do this, but I need to make sure that I'm 100% ready. Went up there, absolutely loved it, and then started training again ever since. So yeah, it was a bit of a quick transition.
And how easy do you find, you know, this, you talk about this sort of needing to play it for fun and for love. I mean, as the game gets more professional, as you know, as we talked before about expectations and so on, do you find that an easy place to stay in, or does that get harder and harder? Does that become a bit of a battle just to keep it fun?
Yeah, it definitely does become a battle when things, you know, women's game now is getting to a stage where, you know, before it wasn't always about winning because, you know, people were pumping so much money into the women's game. You know, now the clubs are getting on board, you know, they're really backing teams. It does become that added pressure, but that's what we've wanted all along. You know, we've wanted to get to a stage now where people take us seriously. They fund us in the right way. We get the best treatment that we can. We get the best facilities. So we have to perform now. You know, so here you go. Here's what you want. We want a trophy. You know, so it does become that. But I think for me, I just try and stay, like I said earlier, as that little girl in the street. When I go to training, if I score a goal in an empty net, I want to celebrate, you know, because I've scored a goal. I get frustrated, of course. I'm not happy 100% of the time. I get frustrated with my own performance. I get frustrated, but I need to try. I always try and get myself back into that area where I'm happy, I'm having fun. You know, like I said, that's when I play my best football, and that's probably when, you know, the girls want to be around me. They probably don't want to be around me when I'm moody and, you know, not happy. But yeah, I just try and always resort myself back to that young girl who's down the park playing with two jumpers as a goalpost. And that's how I try and do it.
Trying to be Thierry Henry.
Yeah, exactly. The goal he scored against Man United. That I've been trying that one for since I was a baby.
Would that be the dream, would it?
It would be. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I mean, I can try.
That was the sort of hook.
Flicking and
around.
Volley, yeah.
Barthez, was
yeah.
It? Yeah. I mean, well, you talk about sort of developing finishing skills, but when Henry first moved to Arsenal, I mean,
he
wasn't a finisher. I mean, it's amazing to look back and just think that he needed to work on his finishing as well.
Yeah, well, if the best in the world has to do it, then you have to do it as well.
Is he still the best to do that? I mean, if you think back to World Cups, when was the first World Cup you remember watching, whether it was men or women?
The first World Cup I remember watching at school when Ronaldinho scored against David Seaman.
Okay.
I remember the whole school was watching it and we all just, yeah, we didn't know what to do. That's my only kind of thing that I remember from the World Cup. And then obviously the Lampard situation. against Germany. That would be my next one, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 2002, I mean, Michael Owen was going strong then.
He was amazing.
Do you see any, if you watch much Michael Owen as well?
I mean, when I was growing up, you know, I was always, you know, watching these players. And one thing, you know, that I learned a lot of the coaches would say to me about Michael Owen, you know, I got to a stage at football where I was getting really annoyed when I didn't get the ball when I wanted it. And the coaches made me watch Michael Owen and said, look how many runs he makes until he gets the ball. And then he actually scores when he gets the ball. And he makes so many runs that, you know, people don't watch. You know, he'll dart here, he'll dart there. And then the one time the ball gets played through, he scores. You know, so I had to watch a lot of that because obviously I was just getting frustrated because I'm making the run. Why aren't you passing me the ball? Like, I'm there, pass me the ball. But then obviously there's other situations in football. I had to watch Michael Owen to see how many times he would run until he got the ball.
And so, and then would you be spending a lot of time watching the game? I mean, club game, international game?
Football game was on in my house. Every football game. Even it was Premier League, it was international. Every football game you could think of was in my house. My family were absolutely football crazy. Still I am. My dad is still football crazy. But back when I was younger, I would sit right in front of the TV and I'd just watch every single game.
But like you say, I mean, it's, I guess, another sign of how I mean, was there any women's football on then? I mean,
really the FA Cup final that would be on TV at the time. Not much really else. But like I said, I would go down and watch, you know, the local team. My mum would take me there every Sunday to go and watch them play. Everything was just about football. As long as I could watch a game of football, I was happy.
And let's talk about the development of the women's game. I mean, what have been the key sort of stages of development? How far has it come? How far has it still got to go?
I think, you know, the first thing would be, you know, some of the girls turning professional in the league. You know, there was a time period where you had some teams who were kind of becoming professional and some who weren't anywhere near it. You had some teams where you had half the team was professional, half the team wasn't. So some people would be waiting around all day to do training in the evenings, where some people were coming from work in the evening. So, you know, it went through a real transition period. And I think that went all the way up probably until the World Cup. You know, some of the England girls were on central contracts, so they could be full-time. But obviously not everyone had that luxury. You know, a lot of people had to work full-time alongside it. It was probably the World Cup when it really kind of took off, with people taking it a bit more seriously. Obviously, we won a bronze medal. That definitely helped, of course. And then I think that's when the clubs really started to see the growth of women's football in this country. And I think people started to realise it's going to get to a stage now where it's going to keep growing and keep progressing. I think definitely the World Cup. And then probably just after just before the Euros, I think people started to really push into it as well. And I think this year has probably been the best that it's been. The last 2 years have been the best that it's been for women's football, I think, in the growth and, you know, how much the clubs now are pushing into the women's game and taking it more seriously.
I guess the fact that Man U didn't even have a team up till a couple of years ago, I mean, that's, I think a lot of, well, I was certainly quite shocked that it has taken so long, but again, progress at last.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's nice to see also that they haven't just done it like as a token gesture. They're taking it seriously. You know, their players are professional. They get treated like professionals. They get the best hotels to stay in. They travel, you know, the day before a game. None of them have to work alongside, you know. And it's nice to see that they're really taking it seriously. And, you know, they're trying to become the next powerhouse in women's football. And, you know, it takes teams like Man United, like Chelsea, like Man City to go, okay, we need to do this seriously now, for other teams to start taking notice. Obviously, you know, Southampton are up and coming, you know, they've put a lot of money into it. Brighton have put a lot of money into it, you know. It is growing slowly, but it takes not so much the big clubs, because like, obviously we don't want to label it like that, but it takes them teams to go, right, okay, we're going to do this seriously now. If you want to keep up with us, then you have to start doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Which is obviously happening in the men's game also.
So how would you, I mean, if you're talking about Chelsea, sadly, you're not paid the same as Eden Hazard. But you know, how was the treatment that you would get from the club different to how Hazard would have it? How was the day to day operation? Yeah, if you go into the training ground, are you afforded the same respect and treatment there as he is?
Over the last few years, it's definitely got better. I think now we're treated pretty much the same. We train at the Cobham training ground. We have our own building there. We have our own pitch there. We have our own gym. You know, and when I first came to Chelsea, you know, it was a bit kind of the women's and the men. You know, we were separated, you know. The women's had their own medical department who had to deal with the injuries. The men had theirs and everything like that. And, you know, and now, you know, if there's an injury, the men's doctor will get involved with it and look at the scans and do everything that they need to do to make sure that you're ready, you know. And that's a massive thing, you know, to be involved in something like that. And for me, when I had my injury, you know, I was able to go into the men's building, use the pool, use the hydro works, you know, and that would never have happened a few years ago, you know. It was very secluded. So it's getting much, much better. I think, you know, obviously in some clubs, you know, there still is that divide. But I think, you know, it just shows that the influence that it has on the team when you are able to use these world-class facilities, you know, that it's no wonder the likes of Arsenal, Man City, Chelsea, Lyon, Barcelona, you know, are the top teams in Europe at the moment, because, you know, they have access to these amazing facilities, and, you know, and that's the way that it should be.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no,
so
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
How much do you read and how much do you try and follow? I mean, there are still debates out there. I mean, we all have to be wary of what's on social media. But, you know, still, if we put up articles about women's football, there is still an extraordinary amount of responses, which are, it's rubbish, you know. that's one of the politer ones. Yeah. I mean, you must see it. Do you still get shocked by it?
I wouldn't say shocked by it. I think it's something I think that is going to be around for a long time. I think because obviously a lot of people, you know, have grown up being told that girls aren't allowed to play football or girls are rubbish at football or whatever they've been told when they're growing up, you know. And it's our job to try and change as many stereotypes as we possibly can and, you know, encourage young girls to play football at school. So then when the boys are playing football, they look at the girl and don't see them as any other different than a footballer. You know, when I was growing up, I played football with the boys, and I would like to think that them boys who I played with, if they ever hear someone say a comment about a female footballer, they say, hold on, there was a girl at school and she was pretty good. Mm. We're constantly trying to change stereotypes, but we can't change people who are stuck in that way. It's impossible.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got something in your head and you're stubborn enough to keep it there, we can't change that, you know. But there's been so many times when people have come down, you know, older men or, you know, dads or even just, you know, women, you know, parents who are bringing their kids along. When they watch, they go, do you know what? I was really skeptical about coming to watch this. I've watched it on TV and haven't been too fussed, but coming down here, it was amazing. And they're like, and we'll be back next week, you know. So I think it takes someone to actually be willing to open up to experience it,
yeah,
to want to change their mind. But you can't expect everyone's going to want to change their mind because they've been grown up that way. But we're trying everything we can to try and change those stereotypes, and the more we become more professional, the better the game is getting and the faster the game is getting. So hopefully we can continue to grow and develop as footballers and, you know, change a few more stereotypes.
I mean, it is amazing when you look back and think that the women's football was actually banned for most of the 20th century by the Football Association, you know, the one body that's
when they had
to be
amazing fans there as well watching the women's.
I mean, any time I sort of point that out to people and say, well, this is a reason perhaps why the women's game still needs a lot of development. It's an amazing fact to look back on.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, you know, it's taken a long time for people to be even become professional footballers. You know, you still have, you know, you look at the Premier League and then you look at, you know, the leagues below. It's probably until you get maybe near out of, you know, league football where people aren't professional. You know, in our league, you have WSL1. That's professional. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, apart from obviously you've got Man United who are professional in WSL2. But after that, everyone is pretty much part-time, and, you know, have to work all day, then go and train. You know, how do you expect people to play at the same level or intensity or whatever when someone's sitting, you sit at a desk 9 to 5 all day, you go home, you're knackered.
Mm.
So, you know, it's difficult. And, you know, for us, we are fully aware that we are never going to achieve the same physical attributes as a male. You know, I am never going to be able to achieve the same speed of running as Eden Hazard. The power he has when he runs, I'm never going to be able to beat Gary Cahill to a header. Like, I'm not stupid. Like, I understand that, you know, we are different, you know. But what we want to achieve is that, you know, we are at the top level for women's football. You know, it's completely different because of the physical attributes and everything like that. You know, women's football, we are at the top level. And that's how we want people to see us.
And you just have to keep sort of overcoming the hurdles. I mean, the Ballon d'Or ceremony with the twerking incident.
Well, it was in French and I obviously can't speak French. So I had no idea what was going on until I looked at my phone and everyone was like, did you see what he said? I was like, no, they were just laughing. Like, I don't know what they said. But yeah, obviously, you know, I don't think it was meant in any kind of, you know, sexist way or anything like that. I think it was just trying to be a joke. But it just highlights now still, you know, how far we need to still come with things like that. And, you know, it is getting better. And like I said, it's now changing where people think, you know, that's a funny joke to actually know it's a bit inappropriate.
Do you ever respond to the social media, the keyboard warriors? Have you ever bite on that when you do get stick?
Sometimes, not in like a malicious way. I try and make it into something like funny or like, you know, like if someone says that I'm rubbish or, you know, I remember one time, it was my first season at Chelsea, I think, we were playing that evening against Sunderland for the title, and someone had tweeted me something like, oh, I think Fran Kirby is rubbish. I really hope she doesn't score tonight so people start going on about her or something. And I actually favourited the tweet, went out and scored 2 goals. And then she tweeted me again later saying, OK, I'm sorry, like, well done. Like, do you know what I mean? So I try not to react in like a, oh, shut up kind of thing. But some things do make your blood boil a little bit when you've got people writing things on comments that shouldn't be written. You know, there's one where someone had been taken ill in a game and most of the comments were like, well, she should have been in the kitchen then. And it's like, that's not about football anymore. That's about someone's well-being.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't say that about your daughter if she went and played football or went and played sport and she collapsed. You wouldn't say, well, she should be in the kitchen.
Mm.
So, you know, there are some things, but, you know, you just kind of sometimes have to just rise above it and just, you know, focus on yourself and focus on how you can prove them wrong in a way.
The weird thing about always strikes me is, we'll say, when we put up articles and sadly they do sometimes get angry responses, is this sort of weird thing of someone feeling threat, as if it's a threat to their game. I mean, no one's saying that men's football shouldn't still be celebrated and have the profile it is, are they? I mean, it's just trying to give a little more balance.
Yeah, I mean, I it might be a case of that, you know. Obviously, you know, football has been such a male-dominated sport, you know. Can't imagine how it would feel to have that taken away from you, but it would never get taken away from you. We are all fully aware that the main sport in this country is men's football. We are not hidden away by that at all, and we know that that's the way it is. But, you know, we deserve to be looked at it as footballers also. You know, it doesn't matter whether we're male or whether we're female, you know, we're just playing a sport that this whole country loves.
And like you say, this summer could, I mean, if England do well, could really, you know, transform perceptions again. I mean, just talk us through what Phil Neville's brought to it. I mean, there was a lot of talk when he was appointed, a lot of questioning, and, well, thus far, he's proving a lot of people wrong.
Yeah, he's a great guy to start off with. You know, sometimes in the women's game, you know, people don't get on with someone or anything like that, you know, but it has changed as we become more professional. And I think, you know, he's come in and really, obviously, his sister is the netball coach, so she's obviously given him a bit of homework on how to deal with females, and, you know, because it is different than the men's game, you know. We want to be told why we're not playing. You know, we're disappointed. We're disappointed if we're not playing or you haven't picked us. Why have you not picked us? What are you thinking about me? You know, so it's having them honest conversations, you know.
Do you think that is different, a different challenge to a coach from the men's game?
I wouldn't say so different. I think, you know, there are some male players who obviously are disappointed when they don't get picked or stuff. But, you know, I think as females, we're a lot more open about our emotions as the men. You know, the men would be like, oh, it's fine, I don't care. You know, but for us, we want to know why. We want to know what we can do to get better. Obviously, I haven't been in a male environment, so it might be like that as well. But, you know,
community's almost like communication is a bigger deal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think he learned that very quickly in his job. And, you know, he's now more aware that we're quite chilled. Like, we like to go out in the day and we like to, you know, if we've got a game, we don't want to have 100 meetings. We want to go out and have a coffee, or people want to go and sleep, or, you know, there's so many different things that he is learning about us. And, you know, he's trying to build relationships with you as a footballer and as a person, which I think probably doesn't happen as much in the male game. I think it's more, I'm your coach. When you're working with me, that's when we work. But when you go away, I don't really care what you do, in a way. Whereas, you know, he's always messaging, you know, how's your day? How are you? It's more kind of building that relationship as well, because I think he's learned through his sister, you know, that we like to feel trusted in that kind of situation. And if I feel like you trust me, then I'm going to trust you, and then it's just going to build that better relationship.
WhatsApp, I hear there's a lot of WhatsApp messaging goes on, isn't it?
Yeah, so we all have a WhatsApp group now. So it's like with obviously yourself as a player, Phil, the assistant coach, and then like the strength and conditioning coach, the doctor, medical team. So we all just kind of put in little bits and bobs, you know, and just seeing how you are, catching up with, have you just read that you've got a little niggle, like what's going on and stuff like that. So you're always in constant contact, to be fair. And he's always, you know, messaging after games, like, oh, I saw the game, thought you did well, or saw the game, think you need to do this a bit better. So it's all very honest and very open. And, you know, I think the girls really appreciate how much time he takes into actually making sure that everyone's in a good headspace.
Well, you're doing well. Most male WhatsApp groups I'm part of, they quickly descend into bad jokes. So yours isn't the same.
No, I don't think so. It's just always asking about, you know, how was training? Or, you know, like I said, he's asking how the dogs are or anything like that. You know, it's more kind of building that relationship away from football. And then when you go into camp, you know, that's when it's football.
I guess, and maybe is this, I wonder if it is different. I mean, in the male environment, maybe some would worry that that's too chummy, but that doesn't seem to be, you know, that the relationship between coach, you know, some coaches like to be very much seen to be a sort of step above, where it sounds like
empower a little bit.
Yeah, sounds like Phil Neville's happy to sort of feel like there's a bit more equality, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's more just, I think he knows that if, like I said, if he has your trust and respect, you know, we're all fully aware, you know, that he is the manager and he has the power of the whole team, and we all respect him. You know, there's no disrespect there just because we know him a little bit further away from football. But, you know, I think he's approached it in a really good way, in a way where he can, you know, have honest conversations with you, because he knows you're on a personal level as well. You know, there's no point in a manager coming in saying, well, I don't think your attitude has been good enough, if they haven't even spoke to you before.
Yeah,
you know. And I think he's definitely tried to install that in the team. And, you know, at first everyone was a bit like, oh, WhatsApp group. Why do you want a WhatsApp group with everyone? But it's definitely worked, because he's obviously doing something right, you know, because we all enjoy playing his style of football. We all enjoy playing for him. We all enjoy going on camp with him. His training sessions are good. They're intense. And, you know, that's what we want.
And is the actual approach, the style, is it very different from Mark Sampson, and what got you to third?
Yeah, I think, you know, with Mark, obviously it was about, you know, how can we win the game as quickly as possible? You know, it was about, you know, obviously it worked. You know, we went from 13th to 30. We obviously did something right. You know, a lot of people complained about the style of play, you know, because we were very long ball orientated. You know, we played a lot, like I said, a lot of long ball. That was probably all we can remember. It was how quickly can we get from A to B? You know, there was no messing around. Like, if you make a mistake at the back, you know, he's going to punish you for it. Like, I want you to get the ball and I want you to just find the forwards as quickly as possible. you know, he used to watch a lot of kind of Atletico Madrid, how they would kind of set up to counter all the time. That was kind of our play, you know, wait, and then you nick it and then you just go. You know, there was no messing about with it. You know, you don't play, you just get it and go. Right. You know, play forward as soon as you can. With Phil, it's more, you know, he wants us to build, he wants us to, you know, play attractive football. You know, he still wants us to play forward. He still wants us to, you know, get in behind when we can. But it's more about, okay, how can we manage the game? You know, with under Mark, you know, we had to be so fit. We had to just be runners, you know, because it was a case of, okay, win the ball, just run. And then lose the ball, okay, run, win it back. You know, it was so transitional. It was so just up and down, up and down, up and down. Whereas, you know, with Phil, it's a bit more, you know, we want to control the ball. We want to make the other team run. And that's the way that we all play pretty much at our clubs in the WSL. So, you know, we're all good enough to do it. So, and that's what we've been asking to do all along.
Right. So. Well, you fit and you sounds like you feel like you always had the ability to be, shall we say, a better footballing team.
Yeah, definitely. But I think also, you know, we respected the way that Mark set up because we were winning. You know, obviously it was working. You know, we were winning games. We weren't winning pretty. We weren't winning, you know, by playing 50 passes and then putting the ball in the back of the net. You know, we were doing what was the most effective thing for us. And, you know, we got a bronze medal doing it and we got to a semi-final of the Euros. But I think that's when it becomes, okay, we need to be better on the ball now. When you come up against the teams who can defend properly, who work you out and, you know, that's when you need to start, okay, they've worked this out, now we need to have a plan B and we need to start playing. So hopefully, you know, when we become more confident on the ball under Phil, obviously we've been playing some good football, you know, hopefully we can, you know, make the other team run a bit more and, you know, try and play a bit more attractive football.
And that's, I mean, it's that sort of sophistication, for want of a better word. I mean, as you say, it's unlikely that you're going to win World Cups without it, I would have thought.
You have to be a good footballing team to win, I think. Yeah. You know, you can't win a major trophy or tournament by, you know, just kicking the ball and hoping for the best. Yeah. And I think that's what made us come unstuck a bit, you know, against the likes of Japan, who were football. Obviously, the way we went out in that game was devastating, but, you know, we didn't control the ball. You know, the possession was probably, you know, so high. And, you know, when we got lucky quite a few times as well with it. You know, we played Spain in the Euros. I think they had 82% possession. And we won 2-0 by like two long balls. But, you know, it gets to a stage where you come and get up against a team who have 6-foot defenders. If you play a long ball, you're never going to win the ball. And, you know, in a team that unstuck us by playing good football. And that's when it comes down to the crunch time of winning, you know, them semi-finals. So, you know, hopefully now we're in a position where we can do that.
I don't know how tricky this is for you, but can you reflect on Mark, the guy, as well? I mean, we did, in the Times, we did actually sort of very much try and say there were sort of, shall we say, two sides to the story. And it's still, shall we say, I think in a lot of fans' eyes, it's still seen as a bit of a sort of mess of an episode. Obviously, he was ultimately sacked for something that happened that wasn't when he wasn't even England manager, which just shows what a mess it was. But, I mean, how do you reflect on Mark Sampson?
For me, first and foremost, he gave me the opportunity to play for England, which obviously will never be changed. I think obviously it was a difficult situation for everyone to be involved in. Obviously for myself, you know, obviously I play with Eni and Drew at Chelsea, you know, I'm such good friends with them. I think it was just a really horrible situation for everyone. Obviously, you know, Eni and Drew themselves and obviously Leanne went through a horrible time. You know, we as players didn't really know much about it. We only knew what was coming out in the media. You know, we didn't really... You know, it was kind of just a bit, it was just a bit of a mess, really. And, you know, we wanted to be there for our teammates at Chelsea and we also wanted to be there for our teammates at England, you know, who were going through a tough time. You know, both people, obviously, the previous probably a bit worse. But, you know, for me, I don't agree with what he had said to them players and I don't agree, you know, what happened before. But for me, he's the manager who gave me my England debut. You know, and that's something that I'm always going to be so thankful for. And, you know, as much as anything, that's what I'm going to, you know, try and think about as much as I disagree with what happened with him and then players. But, you know, it was a difficult situation for everyone to be a part of.
And you talk about obviously giving you your big chance. I mean, what, just go back to that. I mean, in terms of what you've done through your career, is that the highlight, the England debut, or is it something since then or a goal, or what's the pinnacle thus far?
It's a difficult one because obviously, you know, I've had so many amazing memories. You know, people always ask me what my favourite goal is and I'm like, I can't give you one because there's so many that I can just remember. You know, obviously my England debut scoring against Sweden, you know, that's amazing. My first start in a World Cup I scored, you know, I scored in the Euros against Spain. You know, there's so many that I can't pinpoint, even, you know, scoring Chelsea's first Champions League goal. You know, I can't just pick out one. I think there's just been so many that's absolutely amazing. But, you know, I think the joy that I felt when I scored on my debut, but then in the World Cup also, I think I probably had the same facial expression in both pictures.
Describe it for us.
Just like a kid in a playground who's just scored. That's what I would describe it as.
What is that? Can you put into words that feeling?
I think a lot of the time I look like I can't believe it. I think that's what it is. I think every goal that I score, most of the time I look like I can't believe that I've scored it or that, you know, oh, wow, that went in. I kind of have the same kind of facial expression on all of them. I remember the one that I scored in the World Cup and then I actually scored a header against Brazil recently and I actually think I have exactly the same facial expression in both them pictures. So it must just be the way that I celebrate.
Would you feel, I mean, is it like some talk about, you know, literally it's like sort of the adrenaline, there's so much pumping through that, yeah, you almost feel like out of your mind.
Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, you should get a celebration, like you should do something. I wouldn't have a clue what to do. Like most of the time I end up just running to the bench and just celebrating with the rest of the team because I couldn't think to myself, okay, right now I'm going to run to this corner flag and then I'm going to do a knee slide and then I'm going to do something with my hands or do you know what I mean? Or I'm going to do some kind of dance. Like, I just don't ever think about that. I just think, wow, I've just scored.
So even if you prepared something, it would be out of your mind
when it happens.
And any other superstitions? I mean, number 14, is that...
That's the day of my mum's birthday.
Okay.
14th of June.
Okay. So you're always going to stick to that.
Yeah.
Special thing for you in your heart. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And any other sort of memento superstitions that you...
I paint my nails before every game.
Okay.
Yeah, paint my fingernails before every game. Right. So, yeah, that would probably be my only superstition that I have. I have to have caffeine chewing gum as well before a game. During a game, yeah.
And is that a superstition or just wanting to sort of feel good about yourself or what's that?
It's definitely a superstition. Right. Definitely, because I'm a really bad biter. My nails anyway, so sometimes I just paint them just so I stop biting them. Right. I did it one time. I can't remember when the actual day was that I did it, and then I scored, I think, a hat trick, and I was like, okay, I have to do that now before every game. And whether it works or not, I don't really know, but you know, it's definitely a superstition.
And your type of the type of goals that you love scoring, I mean, are there a particular, as you say, you mentioned the Thierry Henry sort of, that would be the dream one, but is there a type of finish that, you know, you sort of particularly, you know, is it the one hit, first touch hit, or is it the dribbles through or twists and turns?
I like to beat a player before finishing, to be fair. The worst kind of finish that you can try and do is when you have so much time, when you're going 1v1 with a goalkeeper and it's just you two and you have to make a decision. You know, they're the worst ones. So I like to be where I've had to, like, do a little bit before shooting, because then I'm like, okay, it's okay, I don't need to stress so much. I like to beat a few players before scoring, or at least one.
Talking about being at Chelsea on the training, I mean, I doubt it happens, but do you ever actually end up on the same training pitch as the guys? Does it ever happen? Is there ever any sort of interaction, you know, with the ball?
Not particularly, no. Sometimes they train the one next to us, so they come through the little woodland bit and watch us train. David Luiz, Eden Hazard has come down to watch us, and we actually had Michael Essien train with us not so long ago, just to kind of get a run out and field some numbers. So that was quite cool for everyone to kind of...
He's a pretty dangerous tackler.
Yeah, I think he held back a little bit against us. But yeah, that was really cool, obviously, to play with him and stuff. But yeah, you know, I think over the last few years, the men have become more and more interested in how we're doing. And, you know, if I went up to get treatment, they'd be like, oh, you've got Man City on the weekend, or oh, you won at the weekend, oh, unlucky about that result. You know, they are constantly, like, keeping an eye on us. You know, obviously David Luiz came down to our game. Aspilicueta is really vocal and, you know, trying to get behind us, always wishing us well and good luck. So, you know, it is becoming more and more, you know, open. A few years ago, you know, they probably didn't even know that they had a women's team. You know, it was probably like that, you know. So now it's amazing to see, you know, how many more people are more interested in us, and all the staff know as well how we've done at the weekend or anything like that. So it's really nice to be around that kind of environment.
So crystal ball out, where will the women's game be in this country in 10, 20 years? What do you think will be different?
I hope that the media coverage will be bigger. I think more games to be televised on TV. The fan base is to grow each and each year, which I think it will do. I think it will be not at the same level as the men's. I still think, you know, that we're still a way off, but I think we'll be nearly there. And I think it's starting to go bang now. And I think that's the most exciting part of it, is seeing all these commercial people getting involved. And, you know, I think it's only going to get bigger and bigger each year. And, you know, hopefully I'm still playing when it gets to that level. I'm just going to have to stay around for another 15 years.
What do you think? I mean, do you think you'll be involved in the game for life? I mean, it clearly is, it's not just something you excel at. It's a passion of yours. I mean, can you see yourself going into long way off yet, but coaching, administration?
Yeah, hopefully. I want to stay involved in the game as long as possible. You know, like we've spoken about, I love football. It's been my life since I was 5 years old. You know, it's something that I've grown up in. And, you know, I want to try and stay involved in it as much as I can. You know, like you say, whether it's coaching or, you know, whether it's, you know, being involved at a club somewhere, you know, it's just trying to be involved as much as I can. You know, I love the sport and I'm happy to do whatever I can when I'm in it.
This edition of Life Times has been presented by me, Matt Dickinson. It has been produced by Lucy Lavery. To listen to household names speak as you've never heard them before, subscribe to this podcast. Search for Life Times on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app. And if you like it, please rate and review the series.
Life Times is a Times Newspapers production. To find more of our great journalism, go online at thetimes.co.uk.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.